Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the vulgar and hateful remarks that Donald Trump made about Haiti, El Salvador, and the entire continent of Africa during White House discussions with lawmakers over the future of DACA ahead of an increasingly likely government shutdown on Friday. Anidi Okure, the executive director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, which advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa, joins us to discuss the outrage at Trump's insult to the continent's 55 countries expressed by the African Union and African ambassadors to the United Nations. We'll also examine the role of African leaders who, while venting indignation at the racist ignoramus in the Oval Office, in many cases care little about their own populations and are mainly interested in enriching themselves by accepting foreign bribes for access to critical minerals and vast tracts of agricultural lands. Then we'll look into the historical roots of Trump's racist attitudes to immigrants that go back to the language of nativists and racists in the 1920s, and speak with a political historian who specializes in immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. May Nye, professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia University and author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, and the forthcoming book, The Chinese Question, joins us to discuss how Trump and Sessions are trying to turn back the clock on immigration. We'll examine how DACA is being held hostage by Republican hardliners who want a wall and a so-called merit-based immigration system, while the Democrats hold considerable leverage ahead of a government shutdown at the end of next week. Then finally, we'll speak with Thomas Ferguson, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, who is co-author of a new study from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Industrial Structures and Party Competition in an Age of Hunger Games. We'll look into the report's detailed research of the last election that finds the bulk of the $861 million that Trump raised flooded into the race in the final weeks of the campaign. And it came mostly as dark money from private equity billionaires who have been rewarded by a president who ran as a populist but governs for the plutocrats. And joining us now is Anidi Okure, who is the executive director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He's a member of the Order of Preachers in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anidi Okure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you work to try and improve U.S. relations with Africa, Anidi. It would seem that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has done his best to wreck U.S. relations with Africa with his racist remarks about the entire continent of Africa that has led the African Union to demand an apology from Donald Trump. And as you know, Donald Trump never apologizes, never admits mistakes, and lies about what he has said, as he's doing now about his remarks in the Oval Office, which many people witnessed, and he denies that he actually said them. So what are you hearing from Africa?
Yeah, on a personal level, I have mixed feelings about this. Okay, what am I hearing in Africa? It's an outrage, you know, an outrage about one person demeaning an entire continent of 54 countries of different peoples, of different class of people, of different professionals. So this remark really, really portrays a ignorance about the continent, ignorance about the people, and ignorance about the many, many African professionals who work in this country and help to build up this country, doctors, college professors, engineers, nurses, in all walks of life. So to have this kind of remark, it's really resurrecting the entire stereotypes of the past about Africa not being any place to give respect. It highlights again the whole history of slavery, of colonization, of exploitation, of continuous the meaning of Africa. So it's people are outraged on the one hand. On the other, which is the one I'm saying, I'm having mixed feelings about it. On the other, I, on a personal level, I'm really angry at African leaders. Why do I say that? Because Donald Trump's remark might be so outrageous it is, but we've had people doing that in subtle ways time after time. And I don't see African leaders saying enough is enough, not just speaking, but taking an action to earn respect. And they are placed in a number of ways to do that. A, the world depends so much on minerals from Africa. B, the world depends even around the fishing around the African waters. C, you have a number of workforce from the African continent. And D, now you have many multinational corporations going to seize literally, deceive people and grab their lands to produce food to feed the West. So we see a lot of dependence on the continent, and yet the leaders don't recognize and value the resources that God has given them and demand respect in terms of relationship, in terms of trade, commerce, political relationship, diplomatic relationships. So Africa is placed in a position to do that. But African leaders tend to think that they need the West more than the West needs Africa. And that is totally absurd. That is far from the truth. The West needs Africa more than Africa needs the West. And so until African leaders recognize that and demand respect from people who depend on their resources, we are going to have this kind of rhetoric time and again, and then, you know, people will be outraged, and it's like a nine-day wonder. After a period of outrage and noise, it dies down again, and business as usual, until somebody else comes and makes the same remark. So I truly, truly have an issue, have issues with African leaders who allow the continent to be insulted by idiots, who allow the continent to be insulted by ignorant people, and who themselves play into this kind of mentality that enables people to insult them. You know, it's one thing for somebody to insult you today and point out something. It's another that it goes day one, day two, day three, over and over again. There's a saying, fool me once, shame on me. Shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Right. And in this case, we've been fooled time and time again. So the shame for it, for me, the greater shame goes to Africa leaders who allow an entire continent to be demeaned, to be insulted, to be denigrated, to be exploited.
And again, I'm speaking with Anidi Okure, who's the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But when you say the West needs the continent of Africa more than Africa needs the West, and that African leaders are too anxious to curry favor with the West, what about the East? What about China? Isn't China making...
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, you are right. Absolutely. The East and West. China, my goodness, China too. The point is that, I'm pointing at the West because they have been the longest involved and most of the insult has come from there. You know, what is it? I think 2006... former French President Nicolas Sarkozy was asked by Algerian journalists to apologize for the violence and colonization of Africa by the French. And instead of him just saying, we'll talk about it, he went on to say, well, you know, he can apologize because apology is of a religious nature and it's not religious. And by the way, that we should begin to discuss the merits of colonization on Africa. You know, so the insult has been coming, you know, from all kinds of people. And African leaders never say enough is enough. I mean, you just pointed out China, you know, and other Eastern countries who are gradually moving in there for their own benefit. You know, China just have this past year stationed a military base in Djibouti, you know, on the Horn of Africa. Why? Because of interest, to protect its interest in Africa. The U.S. is establishing military bases around drones. You know, you heard about a young man who were killed in Niger, and some of the lawmakers were not even aware that we were having military presence there. So we keep dropping military presence to protect areas where we find minerals on the ground, where we have fertile land, where we have something to loot and bring and develop the West and East now. And African leaders are just watching as if, you know, nothing is happening. And I'm really more angry at them that they allow a continent of about 1 billion people, professionals, you know, children, men and women, and people forging to make a better future for themselves, but they keep entering into these lopsided relationships that reduces Africa to raw material extraction continent. And they see it year after year after year because of the small benefits they themselves get individually. They mortgage the future of the continent for a bowl of soup, for little pennies. So, yes, the exploitation is there. And let me repeat what you reminded me of, namely my statement that the world needs Africa more than Africa needs the world, and I stand by it. If you look at the things that enable even this cell phone we are using, from telephone to a cockpit in the plane to even military hardware, the minerals extracted from the continent, without which this technology would not be possible. Or look at Firestone in Liberia producing tires and rubbers. And by the way, about 64% of land in Liberia has been co-opted by foreign corporations, land grabbing. And the thing goes from there to Ethiopia, via Nigeria, Tanzania, name it, Mozambique, Angola. No one place is left. Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, that has been facing conflict, you know, for over 20 years now. Why? Because of the minerals there, and people are profiting with that conflict, while millions of people are dead. It is estimated that since 1994, when this conflict really erupted, over 6 million Congolese have been killed. But we are looking the other way. As long as we get what we need to do, what we want to do, that those lives don't matter to the rest of us. So, coming back to the remarks, yes, that's the mentality. And you know what? Yeah, he's the president, but he's not alone in that kind of mentality. The big difference here is that as leader of the free world, as leader of a country that is looking to give leadership to the rest of the world, such a remark is downright disconcerting, you know.
Well, do you think it will blow over? Do you think this will pass? Or do you think this is a lasting injury in the relationship between the United States and the continent of Africa?
You know, if the African continents are behaving as usual, it's going to blow away. If they don't, it is going to make things different. And perhaps it might be a blessing in disguise to let African leaders understand how they are perceived by the rest of the world, you know. So I'm hoping that they will sit down and say, what is it that allows people who benefit from us to continue to insult us like this? That's my prayer. If they do that, things will be fine. Otherwise, they will just, you know, like a nine-day wonder, it blows over. And they go about their business until somebody else says something in that domain. So my experience of these kinds of insults, time after time, year after year, it shows that they really don't care. In fact, you have many of the African citizens who feel more denigrated by such remarks. And the president, their leaders will just, one day and off, it is over. These are the kind of things that really would cause a diplomatic uproar, you know, between continents and a country. And it's not just one country. An entire continent is spoken of in this domain. And nobody, you know, if it were the reverse, hell would have broken loose here. But no, I haven't seen a reaction from African leaders who said, okay, now enough is enough. You cannot, should not, may not continue to insult us this way while you are benefiting from us, while we are feeding your agenda, while we are providing resources for your technological development and agricultural development. So a dependency situation that is turned upside down. Mm-hmm. The rhetoric is that, you know, Africa depends on the rest of the world. That is far from the truth. If Africa closes its borders to the rest of the world just for 1 year, you will see an economic crisis like never before. Just 1 year.
Well, let's just in the last couple of minutes then, Anita Akure, at least assess, when you talk about African leaders, they are mostly a pretty dreadful bunch of people. Look at what happened in Sudan, South Sudan, the newest country on the planet that has been torn apart by the worst, most bloodthirsty, corrupt leadership. You've had Zimbabwe under corrupt leadership of Mugabe, who was a revolutionary hero turned into a kleptocrat. Now, there's some good news in South Africa. Cyril Ramaphosa is a really great guy, and he's succeeding a crooked guy, Jacob Zuma. So there's lots of questions about African leaders themselves, and maybe it explains what you're upset about, and that is that the African leaders don't take care of their own people. They just accept bribes from the West.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm more angry at them than I'm angry at the remarks of Donald Trump, really. Because, I mean, the list goes on. Is it, Uganda, you know, the list goes on. And that's where my anger is, and on the people who give the fertile ground for these kinds of remarks to be made. You know, the leaders of Africa themselves are the ones bringing Africa down. Because one of the things we find out, you know, land grabbing, you know, many, many corporations around the world are going into Africa. Since 2008, it's become really bad. They are gulping up chunks of land from Africa through bribes of local officials, you know, You know, we have Monsanto, you know, the genetic company here doing genetically modified seeds, trying to take over the entire continent from Nigeria through Sudan to Zimbabwe and all over and Burkina Faso, taking over the basic staple crops of the people who are the collaborators, the so-called leaders. You have a situation in South Sudan, a documentation made by a French journalist showing how a company from Dallas went into South Sudan in the midst of conflict trying to amass 600,000 hectares of land from the South Sudanese and then bribed our way through with only $25,000. 600,000 hectares of land. You have a situation in Nigeria where Monsanto, you know, went and bribed the local officials to give them sweeping concessions to take over Nigeria's staple food. The list goes on and on and on. So you have leaders who, most of them, who care about their immediate gratification and seem to be so myopic about the future of their people, their short-sightedness to settle for immediate gains at the expense of long-term consequences for their countries. So, yes, you are right. That's where my anger is, because if this continues, if this dies down, today it might be Trump, tomorrow it will be somebody else. And they are the leaders of these countries continue to provide that kind of atmosphere for a whole people to be denigrated, insulted, demeaned. That's where I'm focusing my attention.
Well, Anidi Okorie, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Anidi Okorie, who is the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back joined by an historian of immigration discussing the Trump session agenda ahead of a likely government shutdown.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mei Nye, who's a professor of history and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University. She's a political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism, and is the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, The Lucky Ones, One Family, and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. And her forthcoming book is The Chinese Question. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mei Nye.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Mei. And you're quoted in today's New York Times in response to Donald Trump's remarks, saying that they were sadly reminiscent of the language used by American nativists and racists in the early 20th century against Eastern and Southern Europeans and Asians. And you went on to say, obviously, he likes Norwegians because they are white, but he knows nothing about Norway, a country with single-payer universal health care and free college education. Why would anyone want to leave Norway for the United States? And I might add that Norway has been rated as the happiest country in the world. So this is not a very happy time in America, I would say.
No, it's not. It's a very trying time.
And is there a connection here, going back to the immigration debates of the early 1920s, when the quota system was introduced? That was a period in American history when eugenics were quite popular. And also in 1927, Donald Trump's father, Fred, was arrested at a Ku Klux Klan rally in New York. So let's go back to that era. I mean, it's clearly you can't be that atavistic and bring back the KKK. But so how would you assess this sort of atavism that's going on in the political debate over immigration?
Well, let me just say first, we did see the KKK at Charlottesville, and so they do have a new lease on life. But notwithstanding, the racial language that we hear today around immigration is really eerily similar to what we heard in the 19-teens and the 1920s. It was an openly racist opposition to immigrants, but at that time, the objects of racist discourse were Italians, Jews, Hungarians, Slavic people, who were not really considered to be genuinely white people at the time. And the National Origin Quotas Act that was passed in 1924 was a straight-up racist bill which distributed quotas according to a kind of index of racial desirability. So Great Britain, Germany, France, the Scandinavian countries all had very high quotas, and countries like Italy, Poland, Russia, Hungary, Greece had very, very small quotas. And it was, well, I will say it was a thinly disguised racial program because it did not exclude specifically on race. It excluded or distributed the quotas based on country or national origin. So national origin was a kind of euphemism for race at the time. There were also other straight-up racial elements at the time. The 24 Act excluded all Asians, period. Not just a restriction, but all Asians. So now we're seeing a call for, as Trump is saying, you know, he wants people from white countries, although that's not really what the Republican agenda is. The Republican agenda is a little more nuanced. It's not blatantly racist, although I think at its core it is still racist. They want to admit people by merit, right? And the assumption is that all the unskilled or low-skilled people coming are coming from non-European countries. So if they admit by merit, you would get, well, Trump thinks more white people, right? He thinks Norway is a skill.
Well, the in the infamous discussion in the Oval Office, which was meant to deal with DACA, and obviously there's a standoff between Trump and the hardliners like Tom Cotton, who want a merit-based system, and also, and Trump wants to build a wall, and the DACA, the 800,000 kids in the DACA program are somewhat being held hostage ahead of a right. likely government shutdown on Friday. My sense is that there will be a government shutdown, that the Democrats actually have quite a bit of leverage. I'm absolutely appalled that both Tom Cotton and Sonny Perdue, the two senators, hardliners that were in this meeting, have gone on the record on Sunday to say that to deny Trump said what he said, when in fact Senator the Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, and he was buttressed by the Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who's in the meeting, and also Senator Jeff Flake, was told by his colleagues about what was actually said shortly right, after the meeting. Right. So the whole world accepts what Senator Durbin is saying. I mean, these
That's
people
true,
are
right.
moral midgets at Cotton and Perdue. I mean, and they're mm-hmm. complete, and so is Trump. I mean, the whole world is saying, yeah, he said it. I mean, who's denying it except these people?
Well, we see this pattern repeatedly from Trump. He says all kinds of outrageous things. Then he said he didn't really say it. It's fake news, you know, et cetera. But this doesn't go over anymore. And it's not the first time he said blatantly racist things, so it would not be out of character at all, what he said.
So let's focus on the merit-based system that Tom Cotton and others are offering up and Trump prefers. They, of course, cite the fact that the Canadians started a merit-based system where your race is not an issue. It's a question of how educated you are and what skills you can bring to the country. So on the surface, people would probably, the average American would say, well, that sounds like a good system.
Well, it depends on how many points you give for what kinds of assets, right? You know, there was a merit system floated in the Senate several years ago when there was an attempt at comprehensive immigration reform. And, you know, you get points for certain attributes. So if you have more than $1 million, you get so many points. If you have the higher college degree you have, if you have a PhD, you have more points. If you speak English, you have more points. According to that proposal. If you had, if you spoke little English, you did not have a lot of skills or education, but you had family members in the United States, you wouldn't get enough points to come in. The Canadian system, I think, gives more points for family connections. So I think that it all depends on what gets rewarded and what doesn't. But, you know, the president's kind of racism is going to run into a problem because he's already written off a lot of people who would do very well on a point system. He's written off Iran, for example, Iraq. I mean, these are countries that have highly educated professional classes who are English-speaking, but he's banned them under the Muslim ban. There are also highly skilled people from African countries, from Asian countries. You know, I think when they look really closely at it, I don't know if some of the president's supporters are going to like that system either, because in some ways the merit argument is a cover for excluding people of color, for excluding brown people, especially the unskilled. But you're going to wipe out also people with high educations and very high skills from other non-European countries in the world. So I think a lot of this is politicking, this thing of chain migration versus merit-based migration. You know, when you really look closely at it, you can't really separate it in that way. You know, for the United States to say they don't want anybody to come who already has a family here would be an outrage, a total outrage, regardless of, you know, what the background of that family is. I will say, though, that, you know, the current system we have is very problematic. You know, I don't favor continuing the current system without some reexamination. The current system gives new green cards to countries on the basis of an idea of fairness, that we treat all countries the same. Now, that in practice is not fair because Mexico has the same number of allotment, has the same maximum number of visas that it can get as a country like Belgium or Norway, for that matter. So there are only very few countries that you know, max out on their quotas every year: Mexico, India, China, and the Philippines. Right, if you want to get a visa from one of those countries for some of the family categories, the wait can be 30 years. That's ridiculous. If you apply for a visa from, you know, Norway, if somebody in Norway would want to come to this country, you know, there's no line because there's so little demand.
Sure.
So the system that we have as it is not really fair, and I think we need to take a harder look at, you know, how we measure things like family relationships, skills, as well as an idea of fairness.
Well, the president tweeted out, "I, as president, want people coming into our country who are going to help us become strong and great again. People coming in through a system based on merit in caps. No more lotteries. America first." Now, we know what America first means, and let's make America great again. Those were the rallying cries during the campaign, and his audiences were almost entirely white. They had a sprinkling of sort of token African-Americans. In fact, at one point, Trump said, "Where's my African-American?" So I see that as coded racism, America first. What is it, America? What America is he talking about?
He means make America white again is what he means.
Right.
I mean, I think that's patently clear. He means make America white again.
And Sessions shares in this, and he's actually working the agenda, is he not?
That's right. I mean, Sessions' agenda is to roll back civil rights and to go back to, I don't know, the 1950s or something.
Mm-hmm.
But let me say something. Let me go back to this shutdown and this DACA question.
Right, that's the real issue.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be a shutdown or not. I don't have a crystal ball. But I will say that, you know, in 1986, when after many years of controversy and debate, in 1986 the Congress passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which did legalize nearly 3 million. People here without documents. That was the last kind of mass legalization program we had in 1986. That bill also had a major provision for enforcement, for building up the border. So that compromise between legalization and enforcement, we already have a precedent for that. Now, things are more extreme today because we have so many more undocumented people, and the border has already been built up to a really, you know, kind of militarized state. So it's hard to imagine how you could even militarize it more. And the kind of wall Trump is talking about is so expensive, I don't know if Congress would ever appropriate money for that. But we have this long history where enforcement and undocumented migration are, you know, they're intertwined. You know, all the walls and drones and everything on the border had slowed migration, but it did not stop it. And the main thing that stopped undocumented migration was not all this border enforcement. It was in 2008. It was the economic crisis. And migration from Mexico right now is at net zero. People coming over the border today are from Central America mostly, and they're fleeing violence and poverty and crime. They're not mostly Mexicans. So, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's actually going on. And I think, you know, I don't want to make predictions, but I think you might see some compromise on DACA and enforcement, and it wouldn't be without precedent.
Well, Trump said today DACA is probably dead because the Democrats don't really want it. They just want to talk and take desperately needed money away from our military. What an absurdity. And you think the military is short of money? You know, I mean,
he's on record saying he's for DACA. So,
right.
You know,
understand.
He's just all over the map.
And he's talking about love. Well, expressing right. Hate and talking about love. I thank you for joining us, Mayna. I appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mayna, who's a professor of history and the Long Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University. She's a political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism, and is the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens in the Making of Modern America, The Lucky Ones, One Family, and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. And her forthcoming book is The Chinese Question. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into why our populist president governs of, by, and for the plutocrats. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. And he's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and the co-author of a new study from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Industrial Structure and Party Competition in an Age of Hunger Games. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
So this study is an extremely important one because nobody's really done a postmortem on the real story about the 2016 election, and particularly the money that poured in, particularly the dark money that poured in the final weeks of the Trump campaign, starting when Stephen Bannon and Kellyanne Conway and the Mercers, in effect, took over the campaign. The figures are basically, and you, it seems like you're the first person to have dug this up, Trump's side spent about $861 million, and the Clinton campaign spent $1.4 billion. And clearly, the Trump people were more strategic, particularly targeting the three key swing states and using social media. But give us an idea of the quid pro quo, because we have a very transactional president. who's really only interested in his own ego. And if you give him money, he loves you. And if you criticize him, he goes ballistic. So who does he owe? Because I think there's a direct correlation between the people who've been the winners so far in this administration and the people who invested in Trump.
Well, okay, this is complicated, though I think at some point I hope we come back to the underlying conditions that allowed Trump to sort of come in and blow apart the rest of the party. But specifically to pick up on your question, my first thing I'd note is, first of all, I'm not talking for any institution that I have a connection with and that my colleagues, Paul Jorgensen and Ji Chen, wrote the paper with me. Just specifically now, what we do in the paper is look carefully at the time dimension of Trump's campaign. And what we found is that in the early stages of the campaign, he got a fairly large sum of individual small donations. I mean, actually, the whole campaign was characterized by, for a Republican campaign, it's just amazing. He's bringing in small money on the scale that Democrats did. He brought in the end, for instance, just almost exactly the same percentage of funds from small donors that Obama had in 2012. I'm not telling you that small donors floated Obama. They didn't. But that was a large waft of individual cash. Then in the first stage of his campaign, Trump put up most of the money. In the second stage, as late as May, actually, May 2016, he's walking around telling reporters that he thinks he doesn't need like the usual $1 billion that other candidates had normally spent. Within a month, the campaign changes tune, and where Manafort and Rance Priebus and these other folks he was taking on, they're reaching out to the mainstream Republican Party. And there we find they had some real success. We might remember that Facebook wrote him a check for $900,000 to the campaign, to the convention committee, which you can legally do, although that was at the time a highly controversial thing. In the stories of Silicon Valley had nothing to do with Trump. They did prefer Clinton as a group, but there was a fair amount of money in there. Anyway, a bunch of industries that were like the steel industry that clearly wanted protection and so on. We sort of walk you through this in the campaign. No, and I better take the precaution of noting that, you know, when you're talking individual firms and folks, we pool the money from executives individually as well as the firms or their political action committees and direct contributions. So you have to look carefully beneath any shorthand rhetoric there. The firms as firms don't necessarily give the cash. Anyway, so you got a partial reconciliation with the Republicans. In the third stage, and the third stage of the campaign, the acute shortage of funds begins to show. It's no secret. Everybody knows this that's paid any attention. Rebecca Mercer proceeds to talk to Trump. Says, you know, you really need to bring in Bannon, and Bannon. Conway was already in, but in a lower ranking slot. And then they do that. And then you get a big waft of money from essentially very far right wing donors, the casinos of, you know, say Sheldon Adelson, but he's not the only one, are giving in large scale. And then private equity. The private equity funds came in very large amounts. Now, a few of these people, Carl Icahn had contributed a bit before, but they came in much larger. And if I were actually looking to say, in, just to answer your question, what have you done for me lately? I'd say the private equity folks stand out here as big winners. They came in late. They put in a lot of money. When dark money is really dark, you can't tell it. But past studies we've done where you can see where occasionally the donors get exposed later in a lawsuit or something, there's a very close correlation usually between when they're come into a campaign and then when some dark money goes, if it goes. It's the same folks usually reappearing in somewhat you know, in a hidden guise, as it were. They're just going in for more. I'd guess that a large chunk of the big wave of dark money that you correctly say did, you know, that really was marked, was bigger than Romney's wave in 2012, for example. My guess is that's also where most of that money, that is from private equity, is coming. It is striking that some executives of private equity firms show up very prominently in the Trump White House to visit, but they're not listed as donors at all in the formal register. That's, you know, that's, I think, one must conclude either how wonderful that the president should not care whether they contribute or not, or that they were huge contributors, and it's the dark money. I guess the latter, but I don't know it.
But clearly, Trump ran against Wall Street. He tried to paint Hillary Clinton as a creature of Wall Street, and he said he would go after the carried interest loophole that allows these private equity hedge fund people to only pay 15% tax. And, of course, that went out the window. Surprise, surprise. I mean, one of the things that's extraordinary about Trump is how he is able to, I guess it's some sort of form of psychological displacement. He's able to accuse others of doing what he's doing. For example, he keeps going after Hillary Clinton over this bogus Uranium One story, but now we learn that this giveaway in the national parks in Utah is all about uranium mining. So that's the real story, isn't it? That there was a quid pro quo. He must have got money from the. Didn't he get money from mining and oil as well as private equity?
Mining and oil show up very heavily without being able to comment specifically on that uranium case, because I simply don't know. But look, I think what one wants to pay attention to here is the sort of broad structure of what happened. And what happened was this. When you look beneath what's going on in the Republican electorate, it's roughly not all that dissimilar from what's going on in the rest of the electorate. Meaning this, the underlying problem here is the disintegration of the middle class, which of course then hammers the poor too. I'm not trying to tell you it's just a middle class problem over the last 30 years. And the failure of the economy to deliver for enormous chunks of the population. I mean, there some of the other INET research we've published, not meaning the organization, not me, talk about a dual economy, Peter Temin's paper, Service Storms. And that's what you've got, where the economy really has this relatively small block of folks making a lot of money, and everybody else is being swept into a low-wage labor market. Now, that hits Republicans and it hits Democrats, and it really turns off a lot of people. I've been reading through American National Election question answers, and you can really see this in some of the responses people give. They're really angry, and the system isn't working for them. They take various diverse ways out. Anyway, our take is that both Sanders and Trump appealed to those folks, and it was a very powerful appeal. Now, the thing in a Republican Party is because Trump's a billionaire, he can fund himself for a good chunk of the early stages, and he did. And he just, you know, he's sitting there saying all kinds of things. He's laughing at the Bush folks, openly mocking the war in Iraq, telling people you don't need to be eternal enemies with Russia, et cetera. All this stuff that Republicans, you know, just it was taken for granted. No one could say those. If you will forgive the language just for communication, he bust the cartel of big money that had controlled the Republican discussions. And, you know, he walks in and directly addresses. He doesn't give them 20-point plans like Hillary Clinton did, or endless discussions of here's three or four things we can do on this or that minor point. He comes in and he says, I'm going to try to do jobs and prosperity. Make America great again, blah, blah, blah. People loved it. He also connected with a large number of people who do indeed hold the most racist xenophobic sentiments. And Republican primaries are overwhelmingly run, dominated by voters who are, you know, more white, more affluent, more conservative than the rest of the population. And Ben Page and I have been writing a paper on that. We have one out right now. And you can see that too. But the economic appeal is clearly reaching folks, particularly by the time you get to the general election. What Page and I found in our other paper on just the mass voting stuff is that in the general election, the racism and stuff that Trump was getting actually cost him votes, not to mention the anti-woman thing. But the economic appeal was very powerful. And, you know, Hillary Clinton had actually, under some measurements other people have done, she had the lowest discussion of policy that any candidate in a major party running a race for the presidency has had since they started counting numbers. She was basically running on candidate qualifications, although the campaign is always complaining people ignored their policy proposals. But, you know, they were, you know, 3-point plans for this, 4-point plans for that. She didn't have any real policy on how do we directly address the problem of this giant wave of low-wage economy that has spread throughout the United States and the disintegration of normal structures of careers where, you know, once upon a time you could sort of, if you were a young person, you'd go look for a job in a thing and you might expect to stay there forever. That whole job structure is gone. And that, you know, young people just flock to Sanders. Older folks split, but probably, I guess, on a numerical basis, probably went mostly for Trump. The outsiders, the fantastic level of interest, and it shows as we document in the huge range of small money contributions coming in. Sanders floated the most amazing distribution I've ever seen, and I think I could hardly imagine. 59% of his total funds came from small donors, and he had essentially no big money at all. I have never seen that. And I've done a lot of work on campaign finance and in American history, and I don't really believe there is a precedent for that in any major candidate. I mean, there are lots of minor candidates that have, you know, a bunch of small money and no big money. That's usually why they stay minor. But Sanders really did it. And Trump had this huge percentage of small funds, too. These are really powerful appeals. The population has really had it with the existing political system and existing politicians. They are constantly complaining. This does not come across in the public opinion discussions that I read in the major media too much. They're not strong enough on the, I mean, when I read these national election survey free responses, you could see a lot of people complaining about the role of money, the system's corrupt. That leads them into funny judgments. Sometimes they say, we need a businessman to run this place. Well, now they've got that, and they're perhaps not going to like it.
But surely the fact that all of this discontent was manifested. American people haven't had a race since the late 70s.
Yep.
You talk about it in terms of the age of Hunger Games, which I think is a perfect way to describe it. What they've done, though, is they put their faith in a guy who's absolutely done the opposite of everything he said he's due. And
I agree. I'm not trying to tell you you're wrong in that judgment. It is an utterly classic bait and switch. There are other precedents for this, but it's been done a lot. I mean, and I would add the Republican Party nominees sometimes were pioneering this. I think of the 2009 race that to fill the seat when Edward Kennedy died. And Scott Brown won the race. He was running against banks and bailouts and as a sort of Tea Party candidate while he's taking vast sums from banks. And then once in, he acted like precisely along sort of Trumpian lines that I say the real policies. This has happened a lot, but this is, I agree, this is a grandiose case. And I think its effects on the political system are likely to be profound. I'm not exactly sure that I see clearly, though, what all those will be. But I do think, you know, if I had a guess, I'd say that there's going to be a wave of Democratic voting. And then you're going to bring in a mess of Democratic new people. And then there the fight between big money and what might be called the Sanders-style models of organizing is going to get acute. It's going to be a pitched fight. Now, it's a question of will the new Democratic leadership, will they accept Medicare for all, you know, which Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and everybody else, although they talk about it, they don't actually favor it and they don't move it. Network neutrality, the Democrats are going to actually have to stand up and protect. And most of all, they have got to directly address, you know, not simply protecting social programs or something. I'm obviously in favor of that. They need to deal with the failure of the economy to deliver for the average person. They need to deal with the reality of low wages for enormous numbers of people. You know, in some of this discussion, the best known are those Case and Deaton papers on heart attack rates that sort of show you, death rates that show you that while most of the world's death rates for older folks go down, ours, especially for white, the poor, most poorly educated white groups, men and women, they're rising sharply. And the opioid addiction pattern seems to follow that, too. You've got literally the economy is breaking down for a big chunk of the population, and people know it. It's also breaking down for younger people in enormous numbers. I mean, those career ladders don't exist.
Right. Well, they're indentured, for God's sake. They're indentured.
Yes, agreed.
This is
fully
agreed. First time in history that instead of investing in students, they're seeing them as profit centers and saddling them with a lifetime of debt before they even get a job. No, the whole thing.
I agree.
It's quite obscene. Just in closing, Tom, let's let the audience know how to get this study, because it's an extraordinarily detailed study. The footnotes are huge with charts and graphs, and it really, I think, gets to the heart of what is happening, both what happened in this last election and what is happening to this country. Well, how do our listeners get hold of the study?
Well, you go to the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and unless some weirdness has occurred, it's still on the front page. But if you go into the Institute website, INET, it'll probably come up, and then find Thomas Ferguson. It should pop straight up. It's probably still on the front page. Of that, though, probably on the lower down thing, turnover every few days.
Sure, no worries. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Tom Ferguson. I appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. And I envy you for where you are. Where I am, it is 7 degrees.
Okay. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts. He's a member of the Advisory Board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, contributing editor to The Nation. And he's the co-author of a new study at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Industrial Structure and Party Competition in an Age of Hunger Games. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for full podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.